We'll mess with the December 19, 2014 rain report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the studios of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, with this rain report that is more technical than the usual podcast we produce. It's all about ham radio mesh networking. Quoting from the show notes page on QSOtoday.com, its producer, Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, poses this question. Is it possible for ham radio operators to have a broadband wireless network for the transmission of voice, video, and data as a backup to the internet and the commercial infrastructures that we depend upon? Jim Kinter, K5KTF, thinks it is. Jim is the chief evangelist for the Broadband HamNet Group in Austin, Texas. Ham radio mesh networking began with the conversion of Linksys home routers with special firmware into a robust wideband data network to allow voice, video, and data between hams in the amateur bands. Here's our first of two excerpts from Eric's interview with Jim, K5KTF.
Back in 2001-2002, a group with the ARRL started looking at doing some kind of microwave computer networking, TCP/IP networking. They formed a working group. There was about six or seven guys. It went on for a couple of years, but because of disagreements, whatever, in 2006, the working group disbanded. About that same time, Glenn, KD5MFW, knew the head guy of the working group in Austin and says, you know, well, we could play with these WRTs, you know. They have some power if you put a good antenna. Glenn and Dave, 8500, and Rick, NG5V, started doing some test shots across Austin.
What's a WRT?
That's the Linksys WRT54G, GL, or GS. It's the blue and black box.
Okay, so in other words, what you've done is you've kind of retasked a Linksys Wi-Fi router for the service.
Correct. Each one took a WRT, and they start off with a couple of the Yagis, you know, the stamped MFJ Yagis and some Omnis, and this was back in 2006, 2007. Well, I didn't know them at the time. I didn't know it was all going on. In December 2009, I was coordinating a foot race on the east side of Austin called the Decker Challenge. You know, I'm the guy that goes and begs and pleads and tries to get all the hams in the local area to come work the foot race. Well, Glenn acquired a retired one-ton Ford van with the 41-foot pneumatic mast in it that he would loan out to hams for net control. I'd followed him down to the site, and we set it up the day before. I was giving him a ride home, and we started chatting, and he started telling me about playing with the routers, and they're able to shoot some long distance. You know, they were getting like up to 10 miles across Austin, and it's like, okay, there's a lot of access points and cordless phones, and wasn't too many smartphones at the time with Wi-Fi, but there was a lot of Wi-Fi going on in the air, and they were still able to make minimal connections across. And I was like, oh, wow. I'd asked him, I said, do you guys have a website? He said, well, each guy has like their own personal page that they put their stuff on. I says, I got my own web server, and I would be glad to build something up and let's consolidate all this into one spot. So I worked on it for about a month, and January 26th of 2010, which is what the traffic report shows, the first blip in the report, the current site went live. We were calling it the HSMM mesh. Well, the original ARRL working group was HSMM, the high-speed multimedia. Dave, who was our firmware guy at the time, who started all the taking the open WRT operating system, they found OLSR, which is object linking system routing or something like that. It's actually the piece that does the quote meshing. He put that in, integrated all of it together, and actually came out with a nice little software package that we could grab and install in certain WRT54G. We found out anything version 4 and below will work on the GGL or GS because they have enough memory and enough flash RAM storage on board to handle the code. After version 4 of the hardware, Linksys had shrunk their code down to save money. They shrunk down how much flash memory they were putting in. So our stuff won't work on it because we need more memory and more flash than what they were given.
We're using a lot of lingo. Let me just break it down a little bit for the listeners so that they understand what we're talking about. Essentially, what's happened in Austin is you've retasked a Linksys wireless router. But essentially, there was a version of this Linksys router that was running Linux. That was the WRT54GL. The right, GL with the L. That's very important because if you're looking for these devices to retask them, then you want to make sure it's one that you can essentially reprogram with a new operating system that's been modified by the group here, do this mesh networking stuff.
The basic rule of thumb that I have for picking up Linksys is at Goodwill or any secondhand store, flea market, or garage sales is you look underneath, there's a label, and it should say WRT54G, GL, or GS. And if it has a V for hardware version number, if that number is 4 or below, it will work on our firmware. That's a basic rule of thumb.
You've taken these routers, you've essentially connected them to either directional antennas or large omnidirectional antennas and put them above the roof. So essentially, they're now acting as base station radios that are interconnecting.
For a long time, I had one in my truck. If I pulled up to the local hospital where we have a few nodes on the roof, as soon as I pull up, it would, boom, link up. They would see each other. And that was the cool part about our firmware is you get one within range of another. They will automatically start talking. They'll automatically start handshaking. And they'll automatically link up. So you don't have to assign IPs. There is a group up in the Northwest where they're doing kind of a parallel thing. But they prefer to manually assign IPs and manually do everything, which is what our guys were doing back before I came along. Mm-hmm. And they found out, man, that is a headache when you're trying to do big things.
Right, because it requires coordination and management.
Right.
And there's a lot of brain time on it. Is most of us are used to getting a router from our internet service provider, perhaps. And what comes in the network cable from the modem, for example, into the router is the internet. So the source of the service is actually coming into the router through its ports on the side, and then we get it on Wi-Fi to our computers. But you're talking about something different. You're kind of reversing this. You're getting the source of your service from the radio on the router, and what's coming out of the network connections is what's feeding your computer.
Right. When you buy the router at the store, the way it works is it's the center part of your whole network. Think of spoke and hub, where you have the center hub, and then all the spokes come off to all the different devices. So to your laptop, to your desktop, to your smartphone, whatever. Each one is its own little spoke, with the router sitting at the center of the whole network. When you load our firmware, it totally changes how that works. And now you cannot connect to the mesh node from a standard Wi-Fi device like my smartphone or my laptop. You could if you went through all the trouble of trying to get the software set up on your laptop to talk properly. But the main thing is if you have two nodes, when we flash them, we change them. We don't call them a router anymore. We call them a node because, well, it's a mesh node now. Each node only talks wirelessly to other nodes. There's a really good example up on the Broadband Hamnet webpage. It's visual of a mesh network. If you go down the menu and see the visual of a mesh network, there's an example of a satellite view, and it shows these nodes, the little black and blue routers scattered all over town, and the different lines between them. The cool thing is, the way our firmware works is when you turn one on or bring one within range of another or aim an antenna 10 miles and talk to one 10 miles away, as soon as one sees another, like I said, they automatically handshake, they link up, and they start passing traffic.
So in other words, for the ham radio operator, the transceiver is this retasked Linksys router. Its external antennas are the antenna. Essentially, you're connecting coax or whatever, or maybe you're even putting the radios themselves outside in weather
Correct.
Boxes, so you minimize the amount of loss in the antenna coax.
Right, because at 2.4 gig, even if you got 7/8 hardline, you're still going to have more loss than if you were UHF or VHF frequencies. The radio's close, within a foot.
Right, so these things are cheap. You put them in an outdoor plastic box with the connectors and the antennas right there, and then
usually the pigtail, like the dishes that I get, they have a pigtail of about a foot long that come all, right off the feed point. And so I just take that. It's an end connector. I have the little end to reverse polarity TNC male adapters, and so I put the adapter on the node and plug the antenna directly in, and boom, right there.
You're listening to the first of two excerpts from an interview QSO Today's Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, conducted recently with Jim Kinter, K5KTF, an Austin, Texas ham who dabbles with ham radio mesh networking on the amateur microwave bands. We'll conclude our first excerpt from this interview in a moment. This is The Rain Report, available on Twitter at #TheRainReport and on the internet from therainreport.com. KFIWLR.com. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
So what you're talking about, you could build one of these, if you can buy these routers, I think I see them on eBay for $30 a piece. So for $100, including the mast and the antenna, you could have a mesh network node.
Yeah, it's a little more than 100 because, yes, the routers are cheap. And right now we're in the flux kind of changing the project around. OpenWRT quit supporting the Linksys WRT routers that we use a couple of months ago, which is what we base our firmware on. We take their stuff and we build on top of it. Because they quit supporting these because there's so much more in the software, these now don't have enough memory. One of our guys, Alpha Echo 5 Charlie Alpha, Clint, one of our beta testers, he's up in Waco, Texas. He wrote a nice little thing on his website about why, if you're building a new network, don't look to the WRTs. Because for one, as of April 30th, we're not going to be writing any new firmware for the WRT. Whatever's out there on our site, April 30th, that's the last version for the beloved blue and black boxes.
But people who have these WRTs will still be able to use them.
Oh, yeah. They'll still work. And like for me, when I set up our logging network for field day, I have a dozen or more sitting around that I use all the time. I'll take those out and drop those at field day because I have them. They'll still work. Whatever firmware is on April 30th, on the website will be the last one that we put out for the WRT. It'll stay there. I'm the webmaster. I'm going to make sure that stays on there until my web server crashes or I die or whatever. It'll stay on there. Ubiquiti is a manufacturer of Wi-Fi, mainly for Wi-Fi ISPs to do the wireless ISP stuff. We've used them. We test with them. Back in February, we came out with the first firmware that works on the Ubiquiti, and it'll the Ubiquiti talk to the Linksys. Then in June, we came out with a version of firmware that does the Linksys, the Ubiquiti 2.4, and the Ubiquiti 5.8 gear. All the supported hardware that our firmware supports, is we have it listed up on the website. As of this morning, we released version 3 of our firmware, which supports the Linksys 2.4. It supports the Ubiquiti 2.4. It supports Ubiquiti 5.8. And as of today, the Ubiquiti M9 900 megahertz gear. The big thing about that is 2.4 and 5.8, they're microwave. So you basically got to be line of sight. If this antenna cannot see that antenna through a tree or a hill or whatever, it's not going to make the link. With mesh node, you could put a node up on the tree or up on the mountain and bounce through it and still make your connection, but you can't get a direct connection. 900 megahertz propagation is more forgiving, so it'll go through the trees. It'll kind of bend over top of a hill or a house. You don't have to have perfect line of sight like you do with the higher 2.4, 3.4, and 5.8 bands. So I think this release, it's a big thing for people who are a little too far out of town that they can't make it in on the 2.4 or the 5.8. Here in the U.S., we have another band, 3.4 gigahertz. Ubiquiti does make hardware that works. Here in the U.S., it's for export only. They do sell a 3.65 hardware that they will sell us, but that you need a commercial license for. Well, we can buy them without actually having to show a license. When you load our firmware onto it, it says, oh, this is 3.4 hardware. That software said it was 3.65. It's the same hardware. I've been into the chip level and looked at the chip part numbers. It's the same hardware. You throw our firmware onto it, and it works. Now, we haven't released it because we don't have all the bugs out for the 3.4, but our guy up in Waco, our beta tester, he plays around a lot, and he does a lot of good work for us. He actually had a quad band repeater setup going on where he had the 2.4, the 3.4, the 5.8, and a 900 with the beta or alpha software. He had them all linked together that he was covering all four bands at one station. I was hoping by the end of the year we'd have the 3.4, but we ran into some issues, and getting the 900 out first was more priority because more people can now, with the 900, get around and get back into the meshes in town.
Essentially, at least for the hams, the mesh network now should be able to work in the 900, 2.4, 3.4, and the 5.8 gigahertz bands.
By summer of next year, we'll probably have all four bands released up and running.
It's good news from the standpoint there's a lot of competition for these bands by commercial interests. And the fact that ham radio operators can get into it, the Ubiquiti stuff is very inexpensive.
Some of it is under 100. And that's one thing that Clint 85CA wrote up on his website was if you're going to be starting new networks, go with the Ubiquiti stuff. Yes, it's a little more expensive than a $30 router at a secondhand store. But if you look at it, you spend the $30 on the router. You spend $50 on a dish. You got to buy the Cat 5, the power over Ethernet injector, or some kind of way to get power up your pole. You have to get some kind of enclosure for the WRT that can go up on the pole out in the weather. By the time you put all that together, you're looking closer to $200, where you could go get like a Rocket. His preference of Ubiquiti gear is the NanoStation. He has a link 13 miles just with two NanoStations.
Really?
There's no dish on them. NanoBridge has the dish. This is on 2.4, and I think he might be doing some 5.8 as well.
What you're saying here is that the barrier to entry into being a part of a ham radio mesh network has dropped through the floor. With this Ubiquiti gear, which I've seen, I see it here used in commercial point-to-point links, it's very inexpensive. It's a way to become part of the bands. And I think the fact that we're able to occupy these bands now means that we have a better chance of not losing them.
When we first saw that Ubiquiti had 3-4 gear, even though they wouldn't sell it to us here in the States, although a couple of people did buy them and have them shipped back across the pond, when we found out, it's like, hey, well, who uses the 3.4 gigahertz band? I've never heard of it. Most hams don't even know we have a band there. Okay, we need to do something really quick. About 2 years ago, somebody sent to the division vice president a proposal saying, hey, can the ARRL maybe help us do something with the 3.4 band? Because all we need is one of the big telecoms to realize what's going on, back up to the FCC with a dump truck full of money, and they got the band away from us. And it can happen. They have the dump trucks full of money.
The FCC likes these spectrum auctions. You've got companies like Google who wants to buy spectrum.
Google, there's another one that their logo is the Death Star. And I can say that because two of our core group members work for the Death Star company.
Well, that's not to bash, you know, free enterprise. But, you know, for ham radio interests, I think it's very important for us to use it or lose it.
If there's nobody in the band, then it's way easier for them to back that truck up, dump the money off, and say, we want to buy it. And the FCC, you know, hey, it's government. They want as much money as they can get. They'd say, sure, there's nobody in the band. There's no resistance. Well, if we can get on that band and get that band populated, people using it with mesh or whatever, if we can just get the interest level in that band, I mean, it's wide open. I've seen a spectrum display of the band. And up at the very high end, I saw a little blip. Other than that, it was a minus 105 dB noise floor.
This concludes our first excerpt of two from a discussion Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, conducted with Jim Kinter, K5KTF, a major player in ham radio mesh networking. We'll learn about some applications for this digital mode next time. Audio courtesy of QSOtoday.com. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2014 Rain, all rights reserved. For Rain founder and producer Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73 and 44 from the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com.